The following podcast is provided to you free, as is all our content, at drhoffman.com. If you'd like to listen, help support Intelligent Medicine, and get great values by shopping at our supplement store, go to drhoffman.com and click on Shop, then click on the store. Thanks, and enjoy the podcast.
Welcome to Intelligent Medicine, America's foremost program on health, medicine, and nutrition, featuring the latest on both conventional and alternative therapies. Now, here's Dr. Ronald Hoffman.
Welcome to Intelligent Medicine. I'm your host, Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and if you've got the time, we've got the news on the health front, news on the nutrition front, stuff that can make a difference in your life. And we welcome you to spend an hour or two with us, and we also invite your phone calls. 888-302-3684 is our number. And we'd love to hear from you this hour or next. We already have a call or two lined up. But before we get to our calls, I'll share with you some of the health news of this week. And you remember last year, a study came out. It was a very discouraging study. It suggested that cancer was really the luck of the draw, that merely by virtue of the fact that we're living longer, that, well, humans weren't really designed to live past the age of 45 or 50. If you go back in the historical chronicles, it was uncommon to see people surviving past middle age. And as a result of this prolonged survival, we know that our DNA gets mixed up with lots of cell replications and that occasionally accidents occur. And when accidents occur, mutations develop. And when a sufficient number of mutations develop, well, you're out of luck because cancer will develop in one organ or another. And then, well, nature takes its course. This, according to an article that appeared early in 2015, rather discouraging article, which said that, yeah, maybe 10-20% of cancers are within our control, but that cancer is basically the luck of the draw. It's inevitable. Just get used to the idea. And so researchers took the same data, the very same data, and they reanalyzed it. And this tells you a lot about scientific interpretation, because on the one hand, the interpretation was that it's your fate to get cancer, not much you can do about it. This new group of researchers concluded precisely the opposite, that cancer is not just bad luck. Headline from December of 2015, a new study refutes one published earlier this year that claimed random mutations were at the root of many tumors. The new study suggests that only 10 to 30% of cancer cases can be attributed to random mutations in DNA. This is published in a major medical journal or scientific journal. It's called Nature. The results challenge those of a January Science study, which found that cell division and random mutations in DNA are the principal causes of cancer. So what they're saying here is that, yeah, it's a lot about the environment. It's about environmental toxins. It's about whether we're obese, a known risk factor for cancer. It's about whether we exercise. It's about whether we get too many X-rays, exposed to too much radiation. And above all, it's about our diets. Our diets can have a major role in shaping our destiny when it comes to cancer. And so that leads us to one of the first news stories of 2016. It came out on January 1st. Headline, and hey, haven't I been saying this for a really long time? Well, finally confirmed by a study at the University of Texas MD Anderson Cancer Center, sugar in Western diets increases the risk for breast cancer tumors and metastasis. The high amounts of dietary sugar in the typical Western diet may increase the risk of breast cancer and metastasis to the lungs. The findings were published in the January 1st, 2016 online edition of Cancer Research. They found that sucrose intake, that's table sugar, comparable to levels of Western diets given to mice, led to increased tumor growth and metastasis when compared to a non-sugar diet. So this is very significant, and it ties into work that suggests that sugar drives cancer replication. It's like a fuel for cancer cells, and that depriving cancer cells of their preferred fuel slows their replication and may prevent spread of cancer. This is if you have active cancer, or even you're trying to prevent cancer, perhaps you're trying to, you've already had cancer and you're trying to prevent it from coming back. So another study also came out around that time that suggests that it's sugar and carbohydrates that drive the risk for pancreatic cancer, one of the most dread cancers around. We can suspect that many other cancers will turn out to be sugar-fed, and that's our rationale for suggesting that individuals prone to cancer, concerned about cancer risk, have a high family history of cancer risk, or who've already had cancer and hoping that it won't come back, embark on an ultra-low sugar diet. And in addition, carbohydrates ultimately break down into sugar. So a lower carb diet, while, you know, not 100%, but it may significantly reduce the risk for cancer. And yes, indeed, it's not just the luck of the draw. Cancer is a lot about our lifestyle, our habits, things that are within our control. All right, let's take some calls. 888-302-3684 is our number. And Jim's calling from Long Island. How are you, Jim?
Oh, hi, Dr. Hoffman. How are you?
Good, thanks.
Okay, I just suffered recently a three-part shoulder fracture, which is going to require some surgical intervention next week. And
how did you manage that?
I was walking and I tripped, and I just dead weight fell on the right on the shoulder, right on the point of the shoulder. So it's a three-part fracture. It's not an easy one.
Well, you know, I would accuse you of being dumb, but I did that myself when I was around, I think it was around 42 at the time, and I was running, and I fell, and you know, the rest is history. I actually did, you know, just to share, I broke my shoulder. I didn't realize that I'd broken my shoulder. I did, it was on a Saturday morning. I did an entire broadcast with my broken shoulder. Mm. And then realized I was in excruciating pain, went to the emergency room. I thought I dislocated it, but then they took the x-ray.
Right. I guess the only helpful thing is it wasn't dislocated, so at least it just involves the bones in particular. But they're not sure what the final result's going to be, is there anything I can do after the surgery to help with bone healing and also any general trauma my body might be undergoing after surgery?
Well, absolutely. And, you know, when you have a broken bone, there's a lot of soft tissue injuries. There's a lot of swelling. So you may want to take things, you know, bioflavonoids like pycnogenol to reduce the swelling. Bromelain is also helpful for reducing swelling in an injury and inflammation. I had a subsequent experience. I broke my leg or my hip in a cycling accident. God, I sound like you know, Evel Knievel here, you know. But exercise is good for you, but you know, to a certain extent. So what I did then is I took high dose vitamin C. I took intravenous vitamin C, and this is something that, if possible, I recommend to patients recovering from fractures, because it turns out vitamin C helps to prevent. I mean, it certainly helps with healing, but it also prevents a dread complication of fractures called reflex sympathetic dystrophy. RSD, or chronic regional pain syndrome, CRPS, which is a really nasty problem that sometimes occurs with fractures. I'm not likely you're going to suffer this, but it can occur, especially sometimes with ankle fractures. All right, so
for vitamin C, what oral dose would you recommend?
I would recommend you can really fill your tank with vitamin C by taking 500 to 1,000.
Okay.
But you have to take a lot of times a day, like 4 to 6 times a day, just at intervals of the day to keep your levels high. I would also take D to facilitate bone repair. Mm-hmm. There's a new supplement that I really like for bone repair, and I actually had a very interesting case of a guy who has multiple myeloma, one of my patients, who was getting chronic fractures because it's a bone-thinning condition. He was getting fractures just from coughing or from rolling over. Mm-hmm. You know, his bones were turning to mush. And so we gave him strontium, but we also gave him something called Austinol. And I think the Austinol really made a difference in healing his bones. It's a bone morphogenic protein, which actually is based on a surgical technique where they literally sprinkle this magic elixir on your bones, and it helps the bones repair and knit together. But taking it orally, there are also some polypeptides that get absorbed that facilitate bone repair. It's called Ostinol, O-S-T-I-N-O-L.
And that's over-the-counter and helpful?
Yeah, it's over-the-counter. Okay. It's a little bit of a pricey product. By the way, any of the stuff that I've mentioned, okay, usually available through drhoffman.com, through our store.
Right.
And it's a pricey product, but we don't jack up the price. We try to offer it as economically as possible, but it is a very premium kind of product. We also use it for osteoporosis. That can be helpful.
Yeah, about 50. Is that sufficient for bone repair at 50, or should they be higher than that when I'm supplementing the D? Right now it's about 50, the last blood work I had done.
50's good.
Okay.
50's good. Yeah,
okay.
You don't want to jack it up, you know, extremely high.
Right.
That's adequate for bone repair.
Okay.
And, what else? Just the whole complement of nutrients, because that kind of goes into the bone matrix. You may want to take something like OsteoSupport. That may help as well. OsteoSupport has all the ingredients necessary for bone, for osteoporosis, and for bone repair. Thanks very much for your call. Hey, all the best to you. A swift recovery. And, the key to it is physical therapy. So keep mobilizing that shoulder when they tell you to do the exercise. They can be painful at first, but you got to, grit it out and do the right physical therapy, and you won't have a frozen shoulder afterwards. All the best to you, Jim. I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman, 888-302-3684. That's our number for phone calls. We invite you to call us. We got lots more to talk about on this weekend edition of Intelligent Medicine.
Got glutathione? Probably not as much as you once had. As we age, our glutathione levels drop dramatically, and that is a very big deal. Why? Because glutathione is your body's master antioxidant. It is unique in its ability to repair and rebuild cellular damage caused by free radicals, exposure to environmental toxins, and the aging process. The less glutathione in your body, the more vulnerable you are to health issues. Backed by 20 years of published research, RegActive contains ME3, a patented probiotic proven to naturally stimulate the body's own production of glutathione. RegActive is brought to you by Essential Formulas, renowned for introducing award-winning Dr. O'Hara's probiotics 15 years ago, and meets the criteria of the same high standards and trusted time-proven results. Revolutionary. Remarkable. RegActive. Look for RegActive at Vitamin Shop, Whole Foods, Sprouts, and other fine health food stores nationwide where Dr. O'Hara's probiotics are sold.
Welcome back to Intelligent Medicine. I'm your host, Dr. Ronald Hoffman. We invite you to call us. 888-302-3684 is our number. And, this week they had a big brouhaha about it's not gun legislation, because they're bypassing Congress. These are new executive orders about how we can regulate guns in America. And, I'm not going to get into a political argument about the pros and cons of this from the standpoint of advisability. There's a lot to be said for the fact that there are lots of guns, they're unregulated. And there's also a lot to be said from the standpoint of Second Amendment arguments that this may represent a new bureaucratic encroachment on Americans' absolute right to own weapons and protect themselves. Okay, enough said. But there's some fascinating implications of these new strictures by the government, because there is one immutable law, and that's the law of unintended consequences. Whenever you legislate or mandate something, very strange things can ensue. So here's an interesting article about this. Doctors can report some mentally ill patients to FBI under new gun control rule. So this is very interesting, because it brings up the issue of, will I be liable if one of my patients goes on a shooting rampage? I, as a physician, who's interacted with a person who may exhibit some signs of mental instability, or perhaps I've prescribed a medication for this person. And then, these days, and there's a lot of controversy about this, doctors are urged to ask patients, do you have a weapon at home? It's actually considered a health risk, like, do you smoke? How much alcohol do you drink? Do you wear a condom when you're engaged in potentially unsafe sex? Do you have a gun at home? Is there a gun? And this goes into a medical record, which can ultimately violate a patient's confidentiality and put them at risk of potentially being refused access to a weapon if it turns out that they have any kind of psychiatric ailment. Now, I would estimate that at the very least, it's a very conservative estimate, that at the very least, a quarter of the American population at one time or another has taken a prescription psychiatric medication. Now, that's just a wild guess, because recently it was revealed that 25% of women are taking antidepressants, a very, very stark statistic. And that number may be inflated, but still the number is very high. So the question arises, would the fact that you have or are taking a psychiatric medication disqualify you from having a weapon? This is a very slippery slope. Also, the U.S. government database for, say, Social Security disability has a lot of people who are earning disability payments due to the fact they have mental disorders. Will these people be automatically disqualified from having weapons? And in fact, some people hype it up a little bit. They say, I'm depressed, I'm unable to work. But that might earn them inadvertently the inability to have a personal weapon for protection. So there's a lot of strange implications of this new gun control executive action that really we haven't really thought through. Some very, very important implications, I think, for the confidentiality of Americans and for how this is going to work out in practical terms. I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman. 888-302-3684 is our number. We invite you to call. We got lots more to talk about when we return on this weekend edition of Intelligent Medicine. Welcome back to Intelligent Medicine. Dr. Ronald Hoffman with you. And we got lots of content this week at drhoffman.com. We've got some great interviews, our weekly Q&A with Layla, and also a column that I wrote on the subject of the Whole 30 diet, something that I'm exploring this month. I'm taking the Whole 30 challenge and eliminating grains, eliminating legumes from my diet, no sugar, no alcohol, no 85 proof chocolate, none of those things. And I share my impressions of that diet with you at drhoffman.com. Check it out. Lots of likes and views on Facebook. You can also follow me there. All right. It's often been said that certain packaged foods are so non-nutritious that you'd be better off eating the packaging. At least you get some fiber. Well, that may not be the case when it comes to pizza. Pizza, not exactly high in nutritional value, made with often poor quality cheeses, poor quality oils, lots of white flour. But it turns out that pizza packaging may be even worse for you than the pizza itself. Three substances commonly found in paper and cardboard food containers were banned this week from food packaging by the U.S. Food and Drug Administration. You ever wonder how all that sticky pizza, it just slides around in the box? There's some kind of Teflon coating in the box, literally. The same kind of stuff that coats your pans. These are perfluoroalkyl substances, or PFASs. They're found in many products. And they can remain in the body and the environment for years at low levels. They're very hard to break down. So this raises concerns about eating foods from PFAS-treated containers where the chemicals act as oil repellents. Right? Yeah, you don't want that box to absorb all the grease. Because by the time you get the pizza, you're just going to have one big greasy box that's going to fall apart in your hand. So they coat them with PFASs. Chemicals related to PFAS is known as perfluorooctanoic acids, or PFOAs, have been connected to thyroid disease, ulcerative colitis, preeclampsia, potentially life-threatening high blood pressure in pregnant women. They're typically found in nonstick coatings on pots and pans. And already, certain types of these compounds have been discontinued by DuPont. Better Living Through Chemistry, right? Which manufactures PFOAs and PFASs. In May of 2015, a group of scientists published a statement of concerns for the long-term risk of exposure to these substances. So, new ruling to protect consumers. The packaging, look for this in the future, because your packaging may be more likely to absorb the grease from your pizza, which may be to your benefit, because it's in the packaging. Yeah, the packaging is going to be sticky, oily, greasy. You have to wash your hands. But at least you'll be protected from these harmful compounds. And yet another reason, if you're going to get pizza, go to pizza place, eat it right there. Don't put it in a box that's laden with harmful chemicals that might be absorbed by the pizza. And it's a particular concern to pregnant women, little kids. Little kids love pizza. I see continually walking around the streets of New York, busy moms handing a slice of pizza to their kid in a stroller. You know, is that ideal food? Well, it's happy food. Is it ideal from the standpoint of childhood nutrition? Well, it makes the kid happy, shuts them up for a while. But not necessarily ideal food, and especially were it to be laden with harmful chemicals. All right, this item has to do with loneliness. Loneliness, they say, might be as big a health risk as things like smoking or excess sugar. Previous studies have found that aging adults live longer if they have more social connections. And there's a new study that says that social isolation is a very, very important risk factor. They found that having a strong social base early in life led to a 54% reduction in the chances of developing high blood pressure later. So loneliness, isolation, that's a problem. Feeling lonely can vastly elevate a person's risk of heart disease, stroke, and cancer, scientists warn. And they even have determined that weak relationships in younger years can increase your risk of inflammation. The effect is about the same as sedentary lifestyle or lack of exercise. So exercise your social muscles as well as your physical muscles if you want to have a long life, according to this study. And here's an item that suggests there may be a sweet solution to the problem of persistent Lyme disease. You know, Lyme disease is hard to eradicate. Some patients get Lyme disease, they get the bullseye rash, and they feel lousy, and they have sore joints. And then they get a shot, they take an oral dose of antibiotics. 3 weeks later, everything's better. That's great. Best outcome possible. However, a certain cohort of patients suffer persistent symptoms after Lyme disease. Not clear what's going on. It's thought that either they have spirochetes, which cause the Lyme disease, that are highly resistant to antibiotics, that hide in places in the body, that form biofilms, which makes them much more difficult to eradicate with antibiotics and hides them from the immune system. These are people who suffer from chronic Lyme disease, and they sometimes require many rounds of antibiotics, even intravenous antibiotics, and that may not even work. So here's a potentially sweet solution to persistent Lyme disease. Check this out. European Journal of Microbiology and Immunology reports on the effectiveness of stevia whole leaf extract. You heard me right. Stevia, which is a natural sweetener. It's a non-caloric sweetener that works against various forms of Borrelia burgdorferi in vitro. Okay, so far this is a test tube experiment. And it doesn't necessarily mean that you can take a lot of stevia sweetened beverages and candies and cure your Lyme disease, but it does suggest a potential avenue of treatment. What they found, remarkably, was whole leaf stevia extract was extremely effective against B. burgdorferi spirochetes and persisters. Persisters mean they don't go away with initial treatment, and also help to disrupt Lyme disease biofilms in this test tube experiment. The effectiveness of stevia was compared to powerful antibiotics like doxycycline, cefoperazone, daptomycin, and even those antibiotics in combination. And they found that stevia had a significant effect in eliminating B. burgdorferi spirochetes and persisters. When stevia and the three antibiotics were tested against attached biofilms, stevia significantly reduced B. burgdorferi forms. So results from the study suggest that a natural product such as stevia leaf extract could be considered as an effective agent against B. burgdorferi. They actually put it out there, and that's pretty cool because it tastes good. It's a non-calorie sweetener. Some people find a little bit of a bitter aftertaste. It is sometimes combined with a sugar called triolose in a product called Truvia to make it more palatable. But stevia, we've long suggested that as an alternative for people who want a little sweetness without the calories, and it may have an anti-Lyme effect. All right, 888-302-3684 is the number. By the way, if you decide not to call during this hour, you can email us your question to radioprogram@AOL.com, and we'll answer your question on our weekly podcast, our Q&A with Layla, wherein we answer listener questions. We won't be able to answer all your questions and send you an immediate email response, but if you listen weekly to Q&A with Layla, we'll eventually get around to answering your question on the air. Radioprogram@AOL.com. And I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman. This is Intelligent Medicine.
A smooth-flowing bloodstream is vital to good health. And one of the keys to maintaining that smooth flow is Kyolic Aged Garlic Extract. Kyolic accelerates circulation, revitalizes cells, and keeps blood platelets from sticking to each other or to artery and capillary walls. You see, the body produces an amino acid called homocysteine. If left unchecked, high homocysteine levels can become a serious health risk. Today, many health experts believe that homocysteine is more of a risk factor than cholesterol. And Kyolic is the only garlic supplement patented to reduce homocysteine levels, a major risk factor for arteriosclerosis and coronary heart disease. In fact, Kyolic is the only aged garlic extract. So get traffic moving smoothly along all your major arteries. Look for Kyolic. You'll find it where quality nutritional supplements are sold.
Welcome back to Intelligent Medicine. Dr. Ronald Hoffman with you. And all right, let's do a little bit of a nutrition potpourri here. And we'll start with this interesting study. Is who's in charge? Who's in charge of you when it comes to appetite? Well, you may say that you exercise a certain amount of self-determination, free will, etc. But no, you may actually be at the mercy of your intestinal contents, your gut bacteria. The microbiome may have an impact on when you say your dinner's done. According to this article in Science News, bacteria send signals to quell a host's hunger. And they may actually, you know, sort of like Night of the Living Dead or Invasion of the Body Snatchers, you may be commandeered by alien forces to act against your will. This is a common theme in science fiction, is that a parasite grabs onto you and takes over. And it turns out there may be some truth in the matter when it comes to your gut bacteria. You are not the boss of you. The study suggests that the growth and activity of the microbiome might specifically regulate appetite and feeding behavior. All right. What they found is that certain E. coli proteins influence feeding behavior in rats. Now, and it's too soon to say whether the results are applicable to humans, but it's certain to be the case. Because the more junk you eat, the more you mess up your intestinal bacteria, and the more they demand the high sugar, chemicalized junk that supports their proliferation inside your intestine, and that results in a vicious cycle of multiplication of bad bacteria and a further demand for the very fuel that's required for their existence, in spite of the fact that it may not be in your interest to eat that food. Very, very interesting study. All right, this item. Can prenatal choline supplements prevent schizophrenia? In working with pregnant ladies, and we've done quite a lot of that, and also, you know, on personal levels, some family members have come to me for advice. I always recommend a variety of supplements, adequate vitamin D. And the amount of vitamin D that's recommended in the U.S., far too low. In Canada, 2,000 international units of vitamin D recommended for pregnant women. Also, omega-3 fatty acids are very important for the brain development of the child, particularly DHA. And sometimes jokingly, I, you know, ask them, how smart do you want your kid to be? Or alternatively, do you have a lot of money? Because if you don't have a lot of money, I'm going to make this kid so smart, the kid's going to get multiple graduate degrees, and it's going to cost you a bundle. So if you want me to make the kid a little less smart, I'll give him less DHA. Yeah. Mom laughs, and they say, bring it on. I want my kid to be smart. Another essential nutrient, folate, not folic acid, but folate, natural folate. We use methylfolate in our prenatal formulas. And not too much of other things, you know, very high doses of herbs may be harmful. EGCG, while beneficial for non-pregnant folks, you may not want to give too much of that during pregnancy because it has an anti-angiogenesis effect. And angiogenesis is part of the process by which babies in the womb grow fast. So you may inadvertently interfere with growth by taking a lot of EGCG, concentrated EGCG. You can drink some green tea, don't guzzle it, you know, have 2-3 cups, but don't go overboard, don't have 10-12. Can prenatal choline supplements prevent schizophrenia? Well, indeed. And I always prescribe choline because it's good for the brain. In this study, they gave choline or placebo to 100 mothers during pregnancy to their infants until 52 weeks after birth. At offspring, age 40 months, 49 children remained. And children in the phosphatidylcholine group had significantly less social withdrawal and inattention. So social withdrawal was worse in children with certain genetic risk factors. And so it's hard to extrapolate to adult schizophrenia. Social withdrawal in childhood is sometimes a predictor of schizophrenia in adulthood. But is it really a stretch to wonder if choline deficiency is related to the recent increased prevalence of ADHD and autism? And so they say that pregnant women with schizophrenia or familial schizophrenia or certain genetic risks may be candidates for phosphatidylcholine supplementation. And I say, why not just give phosphatidylcholine? There's no harm in that. Give it during pregnancy because it'll help with a child's brain development. You can't go wrong. All right. The risks of high blood sugar are obvious. But a lot of people are not aware they have diabetes. They just have slightly high blood sugar. Instead of a fasting glucose of 80, they may have a fasting glucose of 99 or 104. And that's not considered diabetes. Just slightly elevated blood sugar. And we might pick that up not on a casual glucose test as part of a metabolic profile that doctors routinely administer, but we might see that as part of a glucose tolerance test, where we see blood sugar go sky high in relationship to a sugar challenge, mimicking a body's response to a high-carbohydrate meal. But here's a study that suggests that slightly elevated blood sugar, not diabetes, is linked to kidney damage risk. People whose blood sugars are in the borderline range, that's higher than normal but not yet diabetic, might still have an increased risk of kidney problems, according to a Norwegian study. Compared to individuals with normal blood sugar, people with slightly abnormal glucose levels are more likely to have two problems associated with kidney disease. One is abnormal filtration. That's a reduced glomerular filtration rate, GFR. And they might have more of the protein albumin in the urine. So protein leakage is a sign of early kidney damage. And so we know that full-blown diabetes, very highly associated with chronic kidney disease, sometimes kidney failure, the need for dialysis, and kidney transplantation. But doctors don't really know how much sugar in the blood might pose a risk to people without the disease. But in the current study, they found that individuals who have a slightly borderline hemoglobin A1C, that's a measure of average blood sugar over several months, they found that a higher hemoglobin A1C, not diabetes, but maybe, you know, probably what they're considering slightly high, 5.9, 6.1, that's not diabetes. Usually the cutoff is considered to be 6.2, that these individuals had a higher risk of showing early changes in the kidneys associated with the potential for kidney failure. So bad news on the blood sugar. You know, obviously, we need to screen people a lot more carefully for pre-diabetes. That's why we do glucose tolerance tests. We carefully measure hemoglobin A1C. That's a real predictor of problems down the line. All right, finally, they often tell you that you got to have your BMI within a certain range. That's body mass index. But I've often criticized the BMI. I've said instead there's a simple way to determine if you're at risk for cardiovascular disease, metabolic syndrome, and that's to use the waist-to-hip ratio. Take a measuring tape, put it around your waist, then put it around your hips, check out the ratio, do the division. If it's greater than 1 as a male, or if it's greater than 0.8 as a female, you're at high risk. New studies found that BMI was not a very good predictor of the risk of cardiovascular death, but waist-hip ratio was a far better marker in terms of your risk of dying of heart disease. So get that tape measure out. Very simple test. Check it out. If it's abnormal, you need to get on the stick. I'm Dr. Ronald Hoffman. Please call us at 888-888-888-888-888-888-888-888-888-888-888-888-888-888-888-888-888-888-888-888-888-888-888-888-888-888-888-888-888-888-888-888-888-888-888-888-888-888-888-888-888-888-888-888-888-888-888-888-888-888-888-888-888-888-888-888-888-888-888-888-888-888-888-888-888-888-888-888-888-888-888-888-888-888-888-888-888-888-888-888-888-888-888-888-888-888-888-888-888-888-888-888-888-888-888-888-888-888-888-888-888-888-888-888-888-888-888-888-888-888-888-888-888-888-888-888-888-888-888-888-888-888-888-888-888-888-888-888-888-888-888-888-888-888-888-888-888-888-888-888-888-888-888-888-888-888-888-888-888-888-888-888-888-888-888-888-888-888-888-888-888-888-888-888-888-888-888-888-888-888-888-888-888-888-888-888-888-888-888-888-888-888-888-888-888-888-888-888-888-